From NPR and WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Jeremy Hobson is off this week.
And the Here and Now election road trip has landed in Cleveland, where the Republican National Nominating Convention kicks off today. I'm Robin Young. On Radio Row at the Quicken Loan Center, down on the floor, delegates have just gathered. RNC Chair Reince Priebus just opened the convention with a moment of silence for the three police officers killed in Baton Rouge yesterday. Very solemn moment, and we will listen in to see what's happening there on the floor. But joining us first, political analyst Paris Denard, a Republican strategist. Paris, we always ask people before they join us to test their microphone, what did you have for breakfast? And you said,
I was so excited about the convention and coming to see you, I forgot to eat.
And you're living off the fumes.
You're living off the fumes of the Trump train.
Tell us why, because it's a somber day in so many ways, so much terrible news going on around. But you are feeling palpable excitement here. Tell us about it.
Yeah, and I think it's appropriate that today's theme is Make America Safe Again. Because
that's the theme for the
convention of today. And with all that's going on in the country, I think a lot of the Republicans, the delegates are here, are excited about the fact that Donald Trump is that candidate to make us safe again.
Yeah.
He's the candidate who has a strong tone and sense as it relates to national security issues.
Well, as you know, what your party's also facing is that many of the delegates here, and this is so unusual, protesters are usually outside, but you know many of your fellow Republicans
yeah.
feel the opposite. They feel Donald Trump is bombastic,
right.
And this is exactly the wrong time for him.
Well, I think that when you look at the feckless foreign policy of President Obama and the issues of Secretary Clinton as it relates to her handling of Benghazi and her email server that's connected to Benghazi during her tenure as Secretary of State, you want somebody who's going to be strong. The Republicans, the base, wants a strong leader, somebody who is really aggressive, is really going to take the fight to ISIS because ISIS is coming to us. And they look at Donald Trump as that person who's going to be strong in national security.
There is that. Well, you say feckless policy of President Obama. Donald Trump talks about the feckless policy of past President George W. Bush. He's a big critic, and that's also controversial within the party. And this morning, I just want to mention Trump campaign manager Paul Manafort and Newt Gingrich, who's apparently over-grieving that he's not the vice president, said that Republicans like Mitt Romney, George Bush, who aren't here, are the party of the past and they won't be missed.
Well, listen, I worked very proudly for President George W. Bush for 4 years and have the utmost respect for him and the decision that he made. And so we will disagree on that. But I will say that there are a lot of people in the party who feel that going into the war in Iraq and Afghanistan were mistakes. We have to accept that and we have to move forward. I think it's true. We have to look forward. Iraq and Afghanistan are present, but they're behind us. We have a new threat, which is the threat of ISIS. And Donald Trump is talking about being very, very aggressive in that attack.
Yeah, the Republicans are going to have to deal with how the Democrats are going to say we have ISIS because of the war in Iraq. I know you know that. But VP pick this week was Mike Pence. And I want to hear your thoughts about how that rollout went. But here on NBC's Today Show, host Savannah Guthrie pressed the Trump campaign manager, Paul Manafort, on questions about how Donald Trump picked Indiana Governor Mike Pence. Let's listen.
Mm-hmm. Pence says he got the call from Trump to be his VP Wednesday night.
Correct.
On Thursday night, Donald Trump took it upon himself to call into TV shows, cable shows, and said, I haven't made a final decision. And he was also reportedly calling the other contenders saying, I haven't made a decision.
Donald Trump called saying that because he hadn't announced his final decision yet. The only thing
that
happened...
But is that untruthful? I mean, that wasn't a...
So, Paris, well, how do they smooth this out?
Listen, Donald Trump is always going to march to the beat of his own golden drum. And so you just have to roll with it. And so at the end of the day, Governor Pence is the VP candidate, and the rollout might have been shaky for some, but a lot of conservatives and a lot of people in the base are very pleased with it.
I was going to say, what does he bring?
He brings the steadiness of being an elected official, someone who has the experience of being in Congress, someone who has the experience of being a CEO of a state as the governor, and he's considered to be a true conservative. So it's a good thing for the party.
Yeah. Paris, I also want to ask you, one of the speakers is going to be Jameel Shaw Sr. tonight. He's an African-American Californian whose son was killed, you know this, 8 years ago by a gang member who was in the country illegally. And Mr. Shaw previewed his message on Fox News yesterday.
I want people to understand that illegal immigration is not a victimless crime. People tend to think that they're just here providing good stuff and helping their families. I want them to know that there's people here that are killing Americans, and Donald Trump wants to deal with those people.
And you know, Paris, you're going to be with us all week, but I'm going to ask you, just be brief here now. That's an African-American. You're an African-American.
Right.
There are people who say, how can African-Americans be in this party at this time? You say what?
I say that Donald Trump is the candidate who's going to be strong for the African American community. We've been having conversations with him about HBCUs and higher education issues and the issue of the economy. African Americans in this job market have been really suffering under the past 8 years. 8.2, 8.4 unemployment is unacceptable. Donald Trump is going to be a strong leader.
Here now, political analyst Paris Denard, a Republican strategist, Trump supporter, as you heard, with us all week.
All week.
And partying down. Paris, thank you.
Thank you so much, Rob.
Well, let's step away from the Republican National Convention for just a moment and turn to the latest in Turkey, where the government has arrested or suspended thousands of members of the military, police officers, and members of the judiciary following Friday's failed coup. And joining us now with more is the BBC's Celine Girit, who's in a cafe in Istanbul. And Celine, first of all, tell us a little bit more about all these arrests. What is happening in Turkey?
Well, it has been a roller coaster of nights and days. It has been very dramatic, even surreal at times. Now, 7,500 people have been detained. That's the official number given by the prime minister. And 6,000 of these are soldiers, including over 100 high-ranking officials, generals, admirals, etc. And furthermore, almost 3,000 judges have been dismissed from their posts. And the Interior Ministry today said they have sacked close to 9,000 personnel across the country. So there is a very harsh crackdown going on at the moment. The President Recep Tayyip Erdogan had already said that those behind this coup attempt would be paying a very heavy price for what they have done. And that is what we see on course at the moment.
Uh-huh. And what effect could this have on the stability of Turkey overall? I mean, obviously, President Erdogan is still in power there and arresting all these people, as you've been talking about. But is there any concern that it could affect the stability of the nation overall?
That is a concern, of course. Having said that, no one in Turkey wanted a coup taking place. Even the worst democracies are better than military dictatorships. That's the common ground almost everyone in Turkey agrees upon. Having said that, of course, stability of Turkey is very important, not only for the country itself, but also for the region. And everything that happens in Turkey would have an effect for the EU and for countries beyond that as well.
Celine, I want to get to a little bit more about what you just said in a moment regarding the EU and the world in general as it watches Turkey. But I should note that you are in Istanbul, in Taksim Square, sitting in a cafe at the moment. Tell us, how do the Turkish people that you've been able to speak to in the past several days, how are they feeling about what has transpired in their country?
Well, Turkey is a very polarized country, so we can speak of jubilation on the one hand and of grief and sadness on the other. Many people, critics of President Erdogan, fear that now that he has managed to suppress this coup attempt, he will become even more invincible in Turkish politics. But supporters of Mr. Erdogan feel very jubilant and empowered. They adhere to the call coming from the president himself and coming from government circles to take out to the streets to resist this coup attempt, and they did. So there is that feeling of empowerment, feeling of jubilation amongst that crowd. But others are concerned about what might happen next to Turkey. For instance, an old man I spoke to asked me, what is happening to our country? Why are soldiers up in arms against policemen? Will we be like Syria? What is going to happen to us next? So what is going to happen next is a very serious question mark in the heads of millions of Turks at the moment.
Well, finally, on that point, you were mentioning earlier that the entire world, especially the European Union, is watching what's transpiring in Turkey. From the United States, Secretary of State John Kerry has said that, quote, we will certainly support bringing perpetrators of the coup to justice, but we also caution against a reach that goes well beyond that. Can you tell us a little bit more about those particular concerns that perhaps in an attempt to purge the government of factions that may have contributed to the attempted coup, that President Erdogan might strengthen his hand to a degree that is of concern to the international community?
there is that concern that President Erdogan might use this suppression of the coup attempt to further enhance his executive powers. It is no secret that the president wanted to change the parliamentary system in Turkey to a presidential system, which would give him the powers that he asked for. And now that he has enhanced his authority in the country, there is, of course, that fear that Turkey might actually topple more into an autocracy. And there is that concern about the reinstatement of the death penalty as well. Death penalty has not been executed since 1984 and was abolished in 2004. So reinstatement of the death penalty would actually further complicate Turkey's relations with the EU and the international world.
Well, in fact, I see that EU representatives have said that if Turkey does reinstate the death penalty, it would end the Turkish government's attempts to join the European Union. So much more to discuss as this story continues to unfold. The BBC's Celine Girit joined us today from Istanbul, Turkey. Celine, thank you so very much.
Thank you very much for having me.
There's a reason Donald Trump and the Republican Party are here. It's because of Ohio's role in presidential elections. It's critical. It certainly was in 2004, especially in a small college town about 100 miles south of where we sit. Here now is Alex Ashlock, paid a visit to Gambier, Ohio, earlier this summer, and has this report.
Founded in 1824, Kenyon College is the oldest private college in the state of Ohio. The bells chime every 15 minutes on this campus that's often called one of the most beautiful in the country. Summers are quiet here, but on this weekend, a couple of hundred graduates had returned. Kenyon classes from the 1980s who formed a Facebook group. And this was their second reunion. They walked Kenyon's famous middle path again, the path that intersects the campus, and they sang the old college songs on the steps of Ross Hall. On election night 12 years ago, Kenyon College was the scene of a national news story. Secretary of State John Kerry, then a Massachusetts senator, was trying to deny George W. Bush another term in office. In Ohio, the race was tight, and the campus saw some of the longest voting lines in the country. When one of the two voting machines in the town of Gambier, where the college is located, broke down. Students captured the frustration on video.
9 hours and like 40 minutes to vote? Are you kidding me?
Sorry,
are you kidding
it.
Me?
A federal judge eventually stepped in and said paper ballots could be used, but some of the students refused them, fearing their votes would not be counted. Sean Decatur is president of Kenyon College.
This will be my first presidential election here on campus, but you know, if you look back and certainly the past few years and going back to 2004, where this was in the national spotlight for students lining up, and that was, you know, an interesting, I'd say that the events that happened here in Gambier had a big impact on voting and election reform throughout the state.
Ohio tends to go with the winner in presidential elections. The only time that didn't happen in more than 70 years was 1960, when Republican Richard Nixon won the state, but lost to John F. Kennedy. Again, Kenyon College President Sean Decatur.
I grew up in Cleveland, so places in that area which have much more in common with the, you know, the Great Lakes region to places in central and southern Ohio which feel an awful, you know, an awful lot more like Appalachia and that region. So it's just a very diverse mix. And so I think it's the, you know, we're used to being the center of the political spotlight every 4 years.
The college is in Knox County, which is solidly Republican. The GOP office in the county seat Mount Vernon was quiet when I walked by on a summer afternoon, but the windows prominently displayed a picture of Donald Trump under the slogan, Protect America, Vote Republican. Zach Space was a star football player at Kenyon College in the 1980s. He later served two terms as a Democratic congressman representing Ohio's 18th district. He's not quite sure what to make of the 2016 race in Ohio.
We are seeing some people who are traditional labor Democrats moving over to support Trump. We're seeing people in certain parts of Ohio, eastern and southeastern Ohio, for example, who are in coal country that are gravitating toward Trump in ways that might not otherwise happen to a more conventional Republican candidate. But at the same time, we're seeing a strong reaction, kind of an anti-Trump and pro-Hillary reaction in urban areas and in suburban areas that we might not otherwise be witnessing. So it's certainly a little bit more difficult to predict this year.
So how does a presidential candidate solve that riddle and win Ohio's 18 electoral votes this year? Zach Space says Knox County and other mainly rural parts of Ohio will be the real battleground. And he's watching the big Senate race between former Governor Ted Strickland and the incumbent Republican Rob Portman.
Resources are going into that area of the state of Ohio that are unprecedented. Rob Portman is buying a lot of airtime in eastern and southern Ohio, and it's seeming to work. Ted Strickland is a southern Ohioan. This race in Ohio may come down to what these candidates are able to accomplish in Appalachian Ohio.
Back in 2004, most of the students who waited in those long lines to vote cast their ballots for John Kerry. But he lost Ohio to President George W. Bush by fewer than 120,000 votes. 12 years later, it's same as it ever was. The result in Ohio will be critical, especially for Donald Trump. John Elliott is a longtime professor of political science at Kenyon College.
We're back to, if Trump can't win Ohio, he can't win.
And no Republican presidential candidate has ever won the White House without winning Ohio first. For Here and Now, I'm Alex Ashlock.
Well, when the city of Cleveland was making its bid to host the 2016 Republican convention, it wooed the Republican National Committee with promises of investing in and improving local transit. And one result? A major expansion of Cleveland's trolley fleet. And Cleveland isn't the only American city investing in this particular form of public transit. Streetcar systems are popping up in places such as Dallas, Portland, and Kansas City, Missouri. And in Wisconsin, leaders are hoping that a new streetcar will revitalize Milwaukee's downtown. As Marty Michelson of Here and Now contributor WUWM reports, the project has been a long time coming.
A huge drill tears up the street outside the Milwaukee Public Market, just south of downtown. Orange barrels line the roadways so cars can navigate the disruption. It's all part of preparations for Milwaukee's two-mile, $120 million electric streetcar system.
I am betting on the future of this city.
Mayor Tom Barrett has been an advocate for the streetcar project and signed it into law in 2015 after 11 years of contentious debates. He says the streetcar plays an important role in his vision for Milwaukee.
It's all about economic development and connectivity. And in terms of economic development, you're already seeing the fruits of our labor in that you're seeing both private developers of residential and employers who are interested in being in or near the streetcar line.
Streetcars are actually not new to Milwaukee. The city had a system for almost 100 years. It had humble beginnings in 1860, says Milwaukee historian Ben Barbera.
The very first streetcars in Milwaukee were actually horse-drawn cars on rails.
At the Downtown Transit Center, he shows me black and white photos of Milwaukee's first streetcars.
There's a huge amount of bustle on the streets. You see horse-drawn carriages, horse-drawn wagons, and also horse-drawn streetcars.
Barbera says the horses were difficult to maintain and left a mess in the streets. By 1900, a private company built an electrical system. The electric streetcars provided the main form of transportation during the industrial boom to get people to jobs. And they remained popular in Milwaukee through World War II until automobiles took over.
The automobile was becoming much more popular. People liked the freedom of being able to, of not having to stick to a track system in order to get around.
As a result, Barbera says the electric company decided to remove the tracks in 1958. But more than 50 years later, Milwaukee leaders lobbied to bring the streetcar back after a federal study showed the downtown loop alone would generate more than 600,000 rides per year.
We will meet or exceed our projected numbers. I feel very confident of that.
Beth Wierick of the group Milwaukee Downtown has been promoting the streetcar to employers and businesses who've been locating along the route.
If we just look at our 83,000 employees in downtown Milwaukee and our 22,000 residents, we know right there we are going to have built-in passengers that are going to utilize this system.
City officials want to eventually extend the streetcar to surrounding neighborhoods and to other transportation hubs such as the airport. The study indicates ridership would double. But not everybody is on board. Alderman Mark Borkowski is one of the streetcar's biggest critics and is skeptical of the ridership projections.
We're not Chicago We're not Tokyo. Yes, we have professional sports teams, that kind of thing. But, you know, we don't have the population that is going to make something like this successful.
Another issue is the cost of the project. Joe Davis opposed the streetcar through several years of debate when he was a member of the Milwaukee Common Council. He thinks the venture is a waste of money.
We should be investing that $55 million that we have from the federal government in the areas of greatest needs. That's the only way that we're going to grow Milwaukee's economy is by putting people to work.
But many people who live and work in downtown Milwaukee look forward to having streetcars, including Ann Stukenberg and Marcus Crump.
Yeah, I'm pretty excited about it. It's a good way to move people around and safely and spread them out to different parts of the city. I think it'll be a good investment.
Hopefully there'll be a lot of, you know, business being that will spring up off the route. So hopefully that'll help us, you know, commercially and economically give more jobs to the citizens.
And as for the high price tag, Milwaukee leaders insist it's worth the investment. To build the streetcar in heavily populated areas that have seen a boom in housing and business development. Service is slated to begin in 2018. For Here and Now, I'm Marty Michelson in Milwaukee.
Apple is looking to edge out competitors in the music streaming world by simplifying the way songwriters are paid. Apple has proposed that streaming services pay 9.1 cents in songwriting royalties for every 100 times a song is played. Now, that might be good news for artists, but bad news for rival streaming companies like Spotify, which is Apple's number one competitor. Joining us with more is Jill Schlesinger. She's CBS News business analyst and host of Jill on Money. Jill, good to have you.
Great to be with you.
Okay, so first of all, tell us a little bit about more about what Apple is proposing here.
Well, this is a preliminary proposal. It goes to the U.S. Copyright Royalty Board. And, you know, Apple, I know you think so altruistic. They say we're just simply trying to make it easier for the music streaming companies to pay songwriters and publishers. And if you hear sarcasm in my voice,
it's, or in my thinking as well.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, really, I think this is such a shot across the bow for Spotify specifically, and maybe a little YouTube there for a little cherry on top. But, you know, just remember that Apple entered the music business a year ago, and it's about half as big in terms of paid subscribers as Spotify. I think this is really a way to kind of yank Spotify's chain.
Right. So Apple Music having about 15 million subscribers, Spotify 30 million paid users, as you were saying, but another 70 million on Spotify who listen for free with ads. Now, this is the heart of the issue. I mean, If you're Spotify, you've got to be saying, wait a minute, you can't tie our hands necessarily in terms of how we do business.
Right. And you know, what's interesting about this is that it's really about this free model with ads that's going to come under fire. And as you said, 70 million people globally who subscribe to the Spotify free service. And the thing is that this proposal is suggesting what's called a plain old flat statutory rate. And it would really apply to any company except those that already have direct deals in place with companies. Guess who has direct deals that are already in place? Apple. Oh my gosh, that's so weird. Anyway, what's really interesting around this is, you know, obviously Spotify is going to try to put its best foot forward, but this is for basically for covering years of 2018 to 2022. So it's going to be a long road ahead.
Right.
I should also point out, you know, obviously the biggest expense that these streaming companies pay are is the payments to record producers and music publishers. A lot of the companies are all in negotiations to re-sign a lot of its deals. Spotify, by the way, still not profitable. So I think this is also a way to sort of push Spotify at a time where their stock price could come under pressure.
Now, our mutual dubiousness about Apple aside, I mean, on the other hand, there are the federal rules right now governing how streaming music artists are paid. They're very, very complicated. So why not simplify?
Well, I mean, look, there's certainly an argument there that it should be an easier way, right? But and I think that something that is simple and transparent would be better to the current complicated structure. But I think that we'd all have to kind of raise our eyebrows and say, okay, is Apple the best voice to do that? And hopefully that when the Copyright Royalty Board sits down, they're going to look at lots of different proposals and come up with something that's fair. You know, I also should point out that, you know, some of the people who are getting paid, songwriters and publishers, from services like Rhapsody, they
just
could
a
be hurt.
Seconds.
They could be hurt. So,
well, Jill Schlesinger, CBS News business analyst and host of Jill on Money. Always great to talk with you, Jill. Thanks so much.
Take care.